Coming up in This Week in Computer Hardware, VR Standard Initiative sounds ominous, but should be awesome. Intel 270 chipsets and Kaby Lake desktop performance benchmarks, magnetic fans, Samsung wins, and more. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 392, recorded December 8th, 2016. Kaby Lake Desktop, surprise. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Grasshopper. Stay connected and run your business from your mobile phone with Grasshopper. Save $50 on your order. Visit trygrasshopper.com/twitch. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show. The aim is to bring you the most useful, most informative, most engaging, most delightful, and apparently fastest information on PC hardware, mobile hardware, consoles, and occasionally even a watch or an Internet of Things device. Matter of fact, we have a lot of Internet of Things, but not today, because ladies and gentlemen, today we have the man, the myth, the legend himself, storage benchmarking guru, Alan Malventano joins us.
How's it going,
sir? I'm all right, man. I understand there are 12 terabyte SSDs floating around in the universe.
No,
hard drive. About to. What's that?
Hard drive. Spinning rust.
Oh. Yeah. Just when you think they're gone, man.
No. They refuse to die.
Is it an affordable 12 terabyte hard drive?
I mean,
I couldn't keep a straight face saying that.
We'll get to that in a little bit, I think, if we have that in the notes. Do we have that in the notes? I think.
I believe we have that in the notes. If not, we'll
get
in
there.
Yeah, well, something we do have in the notes. Kronos Group is announcing a VR standard initiative, which is important if you like VR gaming or if you think VR gaming is the future and you don't end up with a gigantic, endless battle of which device supports which game. That they're going to leave down to the traditional, whether Oculus or HTC, Vive cuts the biggest check, haha. But Epic Games, Google, Oculus VR, Razer, Valve, AMD, ARM, Intel, NVIDIA, VeriSilicon, Sensix, and Tobii are all together with a VR initiative, just basically to produce an API that can be targeted by drivers from each vendor, writes Scott Michaud, so the applications can write once and target all compatible devices. This makes me
happy.
And
that's a good thing. That needs to happen, definitely. Because, VR ecosystem is kind of segmented right now, like anything else that's a brand new thing in the computer industry, right?
Yeah.
HD DVD, Blu-ray, like imagine if there was just a common API and the thing just worked either way. It didn't matter what you had. So, they need to do that for VR, especially since there's all sorts of different, methods of doing the compositing and all sorts of different sets of hardware. It just needs to work together because at the end of the day, it's just like a head mounted display and some controllers, really. Right.
Really.
It shouldn't
be that complicated.
It shouldn't be that complicated to kind of puzzle that stuff together. Like, that's why I'm always so puzzled. Like, I know there's some kind of exclusivity deals going on still between with stuff coming out for the Rift, stuff coming out for the Vive, but like when it comes time where it's not exclusive anymore and it takes the company a long time to like port something that was for the Rift over to the Vive, like it doesn't make any sense to me because it's just like, look, you plug a controller into the PC, you're just putting a different head mounted display on. Like there's not a whole lot different.
Part of me wants to put on my comic book guy voice right now and be like, well, apparently you don't understand the initial difficulties available. You know what I mean? Like where it's just, it's always, everything looks simple or it should be simple. But I think the reason that this group is coming together is because it's never as simple as it should be. It's interesting. Microsoft not on the list for the VR standards initiative.
Well, they're kind of doing their own AR thing, not so much VR. So,
they also just announced the specs for their new the Windows VR goggles, which is shockingly low. But they've the Windows 10 VR, which has been announced and is going to come out eventually, but they basically said, Core i5 dual core with hyper threading, integrated Intel HD graphics 620, 8 gigabytes of RAM, pretty low. But Microsoft is definitely moving towards VR. That is coming. So it would be nice to have Microsoft on board along with, you know, pretty much everybody else, you know, Steam VR, Oculus, Gear VR, OS VR, Daydream. You know, it seems like everybody's there but Microsoft. And Scott also notes that Mozilla's not on there for web VR, but we will find out. Qualcomm also, Scott notes, is not on the list. So yep. It would be interesting to see whether or not they join, or maybe this is sort of a, you know, this seems to be sort of an effort for the Kronos group to be like, come on, everybody, it's time. It's time to get real about VR, or it's going to be like 3D on televisions, but worse.
Yeah. Well, and I think most of the Steam VR stuff is all already open source. So yes. That means that, you know, all the stuff that carries over from the HTC Vive, I would imagine Kronos group would probably just latch on to that stuff first, because, like, you know, you're not getting some company dragging their feet. Well, we're not sure we want to give you our whole thing. Or, you know, Steam's just like, here, here's all the stuff. Like, do the thing.
Do the thing. Make yeah. this wonderful, people.
Yep.
Speaking of wonderful, Intel 270 Express and H270 Express chipsets support Kaby Lake, more PCI Express 3.0 lanes. Tim wrote this up for PC Per. Basically, the details on the next generation chipsets are emerging slowly but surely. You know, it's yep. basically going to be like, well, you know, basically, I mean, this, you know, the support you want.
There's not a whole lot of difference, actually. Right. The big thing is that the chipset itself has four more PCI Express lanes compared to, you know, the whichever letter 170 right. version, right?
That's a big deal to me. Because yeah, I'm finding, like, I'm in the USB 3.0 port hell because of a lack of PCI Express lanes on one machine. But
exactly. And something like this would allow a motherboard maker to add in, like, an extra, you know, USB 3 port or two. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, or maybe even four, depending on if they want to kind of bottleneck it based on those PCI lanes versus the throughput of the PCI Express or the USB port itself. So just, you know, it just gives the computer makers a little bit more flexibility, motherboard makers, our integrators making laptops that the mobile version of this is going to go into. You know, it just gives you some more lanes. But remember, these lanes are behind the chipset. So the chipset is bottlenecked by DMI 3, which is basically PCI Express 3.0 by 4. So there's only four lanes of PCI Express going to the CPU, effectively, as far mm-hmm. as all the communication from all of the things, you know, behind the chipset. So that includes, and usually the thing that is the bottleneck for, like, RAID configurations is the SATA ports, right? Because that's the thing that does a lot of just bulk sequential throughput if you're trying to move a bunch of stuff around. And, you know, the actual bottleneck works out to about 1.8 gig per second. So it's still pretty quick. But if you throw, you know, if you had a motherboard with a couple of M.2 slots on there designed to be RAIDed, and you had a couple of NVMe SSDs, I mean, just one of those SSDs can hit that speed now.
Right.
So start running into, you know, potential issues there if you want to go crazy with a really, really fast RAID. It's just not going to happen when you have to go through the chipset as far as sequentials. You'll still see improvements in random access. You'll still see, you know, IOPS and all that other stuff will still be good. You know, chances are, aside from storage, all that other stuff, it's just like a way to fan out and get more PCI Express. Like, you know, it's like a power strip, right? Like you got all these extra little things you want to plug in, all these little chargers and dongles and whatever, you know, wall warts, things you just need to plug in, and you just need more ports, right?
Right.
You know, not necessarily drawing a lot of power, but you just need, you know, a lot of little things that are sipping power, right? So you just get, you know, a big old power strip. That's effectively what the chipset is in terms of, like, fanning out PCI lanes.
RX 480 from AMD, the 1060 on coming from NVIDIA GTX. Man, 215, 210, 230, 250. You know, 220 to
you're just throwing numbers.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's you know, it's funny, right? Because everything was so expensive this summer. Now you're looking at, like, a GTX 1060, you know, a 6 gig version of that card selling for like $250, a 3 gigabyte for $210. you know, over at the RX 480, 8 gigabytes version are selling for about $260. And actually 4 gigabyte versions are selling for like $240, $220. Here's one for, looks like as low as $210. I bring that up because Hardware Canucks, did something they don't do very often, which is take a look at a competing price bracket. In this case, that's kind of $250, $300 price bracket, and take a look at the benchmarks again. And they did this for the GTX 1060 and the RX 480, and essentially updated the review. And what they found, I won't reveal everything because I want HardwareCanucks.com to get the traffic. But what they found is one of those cards improved dramatically between July 2016 and December 2016. And one of those cars essentially stayed, did not improve.
Yeah.
I don't know how else to say it, but it was surprising. And the difference in performance between DirectX 11 and DirectX 12 was, I thought, also kind of fascinating too. DX12, I don't think it's been very friendly to GPU driver firmware driver writers. That's all I'll say about that.
AMD hardware in general tends to age better, mm-hmm. right? Like they optimize. It's as if the hardware kind of leads the driver and the software side way more on the AMD side. Like, and so the downside is when the hardware is brand new, you kind of have to deal with some. In some cases, like, the performance is, like, really bad for some titles, and you just have to wait for them to kind of optimize for those things. But once they do get all those optimizations done, you're getting, effectively more performance out of that same piece of hardware. I kind of wish sometimes they would have done all that right at the beginning, but, like, time is a limited resource, and they only have so many, personnel to throw it at a hardware and software release. So NVIDIA has more people to throw at that stuff, so naturally, like, their driver stuff tends to be just done right at the beginning, mm-hmm. and they tend to not see that many improvements as time goes on, mainly because there's just not anything else to squeak out of it, to get out of that hardware, which is also fine. It's just, that's just how the one company works versus the other company as far as driver development goes.
Yeah, let's hope they improve quickly. Actually, I should say that I'm thinking ahead to the GeForce 376.19 driver story. Because while you're saying, like, NVIDIA tends to come out of the gate and not get performance boosts in the hardware, both companies are constantly tuning the drivers to improve performance on individual games.
And sometimes they break stuff.
you noticed. Yeah. So GeForce 376.19 drivers came out. That's to support the Oculus Touch controllers from Oculus VR. And like 50 something games that came out with it. This does not, however, resolve the problem people have had with folding at home, which is unfortunate. But the quote, one of two SLI issues in No Man's Sky has been repaired. So that's unfortunate. But the folding at home bug is not yet fixed. Right, Scott, but it's now classified as a top priority bug. So
yeah, we'll see. And they're pretty quick on the turnaround on these sorts of things. Yeah.
Oh my goodness! Big news this week. Not a whole lot to say. Supreme Court basically said, Samsung, you didn't copy that much. You're good. Then they overturned the gigantic judgment. Yeah. Basically, Samsung does not have to pay the $399 million penalty that the appeals court laid down.
I don't know exactly which things they were using as far as, like, proof of this or that or whatnot. I don't know any of the, like, intricate details of this thing. All I know is that there was a period of time there where you'd see a Samsung product, like, all the way down to its charger,
mm-hmm.
like, looked basically like a carbon copy of the same Apple product. So
I don't know if I'd go that far.
There were a couple there where it was pretty darn close. Like, the little charging brick was, like, the exact same size and shape as, like, the Apple one. And it was, like, fortunately, that only happened, I think, for, like, one generation of products, and then they seem to have quickly kind of moved away from that. So maybe that's what saved them here. I'm glad they didn't stick with it, because it just seemed kind of silly for them to both be, like, that similar. Even for one generation, you know, it's just kind of like, well, what are you guys doing? Like, make your own stuff. But yeah, I mean, they're nothing like them now. Like the hardware, you know, it's all vastly different now, which is good.
Well,
you know.
Well, if you're looking at, you know, what originally started out as nearly a billion dollar settlement and then it's slowly been cut down, I think you might tell your design and engineering teams to diverge from the lawsuit you may be losing immediately or imminently. Pebble is dead. If you were a Pebble enthusiast, you know, basically Pebble's engineering team intellectual property has been sold to Fitbit and the testers. And pretty much everybody else is being let go. They're selling out Pebble stock on store shelves or in the there's no Pebble support is going to be available anymore. And any Pebble quote out in the wild is no longer covered by eligible for warranty exchange. It's the word that was passed along to Gizmodo. So basically, you know, if you bought a Pebble last week, you better hope it doesn't die, because there are no replacements or repairs.
Did they have to run some kind of, like, if you were using a Pebble with an iOS device, did they have to run something on their back end in order for like the notifications to work like through iOS? You know what I mean?
I think it's the app that runs on the.
Okay, I just didn't know if like companies that did like say push notifications, I didn't know if each company that had like a specific app kind of had to have like a centralized server or something that was like talking to Apple for that kind of thing. So if there was, then I, you know, at some point, obviously that would go away too, potentially. So just something to possibly think of as like a consideration for. When they finally do, if there was a server, they finally shut it down, then like notifications might just stop working.
My understanding was basically just an application that communicated between the phone and the watch. But I'll be honest with you, you know, I've purchased one smartwatch for testing, and I still haven't really found a compelling reason to keep wearing it. So,
yeah,
you know, I'll be perfectly honest with you.
Ryan and Ken had a Pebble that bounced back and forth between the both of them, I believe. And I don't think either one of them kept it on for very
long. Right. Well, yeah. I mean, this is, you know, I think it was Christina Warren wrote in Gizmodo back in October that no one is buying smartwatches anymore. You know, and that smartwatch shipments are down 51% year over year. That's, you know, Apple's shipments are way down. On the Apple Watch. So
yeah, my wife offered to get me one for Christmas, and I was kind of like, don't waste your money, kind of thing. Like, don't spend a lot of money on something that will be obsolete within a year or two. That's a watch. Yeah. Like, you know, I have a watch that I bought myself over 20 years ago. It's still working just fine. It's got a sapphire face, just like some of the Apple stuff. And it hasn't scratched, you know.
Yeah. I'm looking at the Pebble app reviews on the iTunes store.
Oh, dear. That probably doesn't look very good.
You know.
Is it like 2 stars? Average?
You know, nobody's actually talking. I don't think anybody's absorbed the fact that Pebble's been bought. It's more like update ruins the Pebble experience. Not sure if bug fixes are going forward or backwards. App hangs as normal. No change with new updates. ouch. You know, it's down to 2 stars from a previous rating of 2.5 stars. So remember, kids, software that works is important if you want your hardware to succeed. Hard OCP got their paws on an early Kaby Lake. I guess it just kind of showed up from sources unspecified.
Yeah, I think a lot of vendors just kind of like leaked a bunch of CPUs to random people because these are not from Intel.
Yeah, well, we talked last week about the exciting improvements in performance for Kaby Lake laptops. Kaby Lake desktops, at least on the benchmarks that the Hard OCP crew were running, looks like pretty much, the Kaby Lake Core i7-7700K when compared to the Skylake Core i7-6700K at the same clock speed is pretty flat. Kaby Lake should overclock better. Those of us that are expecting a better performing CPU in terms of IPC are going to be disappointed. For the CPU enthusiast that has little or no need for iGPU, Intel's Kaby Lake is likely to be the snooze fest of the year. Hopefully we will see 5 gigahertz overclocking wake the new Kaby Lake up a bit. If anything, this is just piqued my excitement a bit more for AMD's upcoming Zen processor.
Kyle, I mean, we knew this was going
to
be
feelings close to the chest as always.
Yes, always. but we knew this was going to be the second talk, right? Like, it's not TikTok now. Intel was upfront about this. It's not like it was a secret or anything like that. They said a while ago now, they're like, look, we're going to do, it's going to be more like a waltz. three sets of three for our release cadence. And this is supposed to be the optimize one. And, they're obviously optimizing some stuff. I think the optimize, what they're going for, is really like more power consumption kind of stuff and getting the same performance out of the CPU for less power. Which is also good. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with that.
Just a little bump. Just a little something.
Yeah. That'd be nice. Yeah. I mean, that would be nice. Just realize it's pretty drastic. Like, if it was just to get just a little bump, like you're retaping. You're redoing stuff in the CPU even for a little bump, right? Which is the tick. It's not, it's the tick and the talk, not the third one. But
just be rational. Rational, thoughtful, intelligent self.
Yeah, I'm hoping when they do that next tick, the DMI thing we talked about earlier from the chipset, mm-hmm. I'm hoping they're going to increase that bandwidth so that way we're not worried about that. That bottleneck anymore. But they couldn't do that in this one because, again, it's not a tick or a tock.
Well, they don't do ticks or tocks anymore. They're just dropping new processors.
Yeah.
Did you hear them? They said no ticks and tocks.
We secretly replaced the name of the old one with the new one. Here's the new processor. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Grasshopper. Grasshopper is a virtual phone system designed for entrepreneurs. Grasshopper works just like a traditional phone system, but requires no hardware purchase or software installation. With their iOS and Android app, callers can reach you wherever you are on your mobile phone. Grasshopper allows you to keep your existing number so you can maintain your brand. It's nice. When you make a call, your client will see your Grasshopper caller ID instead of your personal phone number. Just select a toll-free or local number, record a custom greeting, add multiple extensions for your business. You are good to go. Toll-free numbers are great for marketing and make your business sound more professional. Nothing says I'm big like a toll-free number, even if you're actually just a couple of people in Northern California. Set up department and employee extensions with custom call forwarding to any phone in the world. Get voicemails emailed to you as audio attachments. You can send and receive SMS text messages from your business number. Join people, join the over 250,000 Grasshopper customers today. Plans start at just $12 a month, and you have a 30-day money-back guarantee to improve the way you look to your customers, to make your life simpler, managing the whole phone situation. Turn your smartphone into a business line with Grasshopper. To save $50 on your order, go to trygrasshopper.com/twit. That's trygrasshopper.com/twit. And we want to thank Grasshopper for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. And Twit. Exciting. I do not miss VoIP systems. I'm just going to say that right out loud. So in your previous career, I don't know if we've ever mentioned your previous career, the one involving being underwater.
Yeah, the submarine thing.
Did we ever discuss you know, some of the crazy, like, did you have magnetic bearings or magnetic fans on the submarine, or was that considered too, like, crazy?
I was on one of the submarines that had a, they tried to maglev, which is just the thing you, the term for, like, magnetic levitation of a thing that's rotating. And the idea is you don't want noise to travel to something else, you know, and you don't want less friction and all that stuff. It's handy. They tried doing that with one of the steam turbine generators, which are the things that generate electricity for the submarine. There's a couple of them, but, like, these things are big. It's a huge piece of metal, and it's rotating pretty quickly. It's like, you know, taking, like, a Volkswagen and, like, spinning it at, like, 3,600 RPM or something like that, right?
That's a lot of mass to be spinning that fast.
That's a lot of stuff to be spinning that fast, yeah. And, you know, they had it was a little bit buggy, and the system would occasionally just, like, let that spinning Volkswagen land on what was called, like, crash bearings, and, like, then they had to open it up and inspect them, and it was, like, delaying submarines going out to sea. So finally they were just like, nope, let's get rid of those things. And, you know, just in time for me to get to that submarine. So, of course, it was not delayed anymore ever. And I always was going out on time and never had any extra time at home. Anyway.
Aww.
Yeah. So there's some things that's easier to do magnetic levitation with. And that's, like, a really lightweight little fan, like, for a PC. you know, and it doesn't need to be, like, an electronically controlled magnetic levitation thing. It's probably, honestly, just, like, a science experiment level kind of thing where you just, like, suspend a magnet between two other magnets.
It seems simple enough.
It's something you can do, right? It's you apply the same thing to a radial, like, kind of bearing there,
right,
inside of a fan. And, you know, you can quiet down the fan. Now, I mean, it's not like there's this night and day difference, because you don't really hear sleeve bearings. The things you hear if you have a fan going bad is, like, chances are it's a ball bearing fan. Mm-hmm. And chances are the oil has just all, you know, evaporated off, because those things aren't really sealed very well. Because, again, it's just a silly, you know, just simple little PC fan. Doesn't need to be, like, super awesomely sealed and, you know, industrial grade stuff. So eventually, you know, the oil kind of evaporates off, and then the thing starts making noise. You have, like, sleeve bearings, which are usually just, like, a, you know, very slick sleeve, like a solid piece of metal. Right. And those tend to, like, hold their oil a little bit better, first of all, because mm-hmm. You don't have to seal them as well. And there's nothing rolling over something else, right? It's just it's just metal sliding over other metal with oil in between the two. So those, you really don't hear sleeve bearings, and they really, right, you know, don't tend to fail, like, that kind of thing. But these would take it, like, one step further. These, you don't have to worry about lubricant evaporating off. You don't have to worry about any of that stuff. There's just magnets just holding the fan steady in the center where it's supposed to be. And ideally, you know, no parts rubbing on other parts, right? It's just a thing.
That would be nice.
Yeah. And that's what these are. They do note in the article they're a little bit more expensive, obviously, because you know, it's probably a little bit more like quality control involves. It's, I don't think it's so much because they're so hard to make. I think it's because, like, once you've made them, they probably have to do a little more QC, just to make sure that they are actually spinning properly and that the assembly went together the right way, because this is not something that tends to be, like, mass produced.
Right.
You know, they're just doing, like, sounds like they're just starting this up. You know, computer industry's done this. It's happened on and off, right? Like, we've heard of these bearings and fans in the past. It's just, it tends to be like a company does one short run of them or something, and then they just decide to move back to the cheaper sleeve bearings or even ball bearings if they wanted to go, you know.
When you get magnets, when you go to Corsair's webpage, the ML series, you know, they do a maximum performance, minimal noise. And instead of telling you what the dB levels coming from the fan was, they do comparative performances at 36 dBA. So A weighted decibel measurements. And they've got like 400 RPM to 2400 RPM. And they said their top competitor is around a little under 600 to a little over 2100 RPM, which is most of the range of this. And then a standard PC fan will get you from 900 to 1800 hertz while staying at 36 dB. It was interesting. And they also pointed out that their static pressure, i.e. the amount of air being shoved by the fan, is higher than their sort of best competitor, and significantly nearly twice as high as on a cheap PC fan. So 76 cubic feet per minute compared to 55 for a cheap fan or 67 for a close competitor. I don't know if you'll hear their performance. I would love to see if anybody gets one of these in an anechoic chamber and figures out how low they can go sound wise. Because I personally think most of the noise we hear from fans is from air moving in the blades in the enclosure, and not from
The case.
Not from actual. Back in the day, lots of bearing noise, but I don't think I've had a bearing noise issue from a fan that wasn't dying in years. So
yeah, and they usually tend to be the really cheap fans. Like I wouldn't imagine any modern day decent quality case fan. Those things should run for a decade. The LEDs might burn out on them, but usually the fan continues to work just fine. Especially if they're blue LEDs. Those things don't like running for more than a couple of years.
Especially when I'm watching them. Except for the ones on the cheap Lapi amplifiers, which seem to last forever, and you can read by them from several yards away.
Yeah, they blind you when you're trying to be in a dimly lit room. Yeah.
Hate that. Thrustmaster TMX review, budget FFB for Xbox One and PC. Josh wrote this up for PC Per. Did Josh talk about this on the podcast last night?
Yeah, he did.
His quest, his pedal quest.
Well, he started with one or two reviews there, and it seems like every company on the planet that makes a racing wheel decided that they were going to flood him with products to review. So the idea here is low cost, right? This is not like one of the much higher, like the Fanatic ones or other wheels that he's reviewed in the past. This is just your typical budget. You just want to do a thing with a racing wheel, and you're not looking for the premium experience necessarily. So I think it's only like a 900 degree wheel. It's compatible PC. Is this one Xbox and PlayStation? I'm trying to think. Oh no, it's Xbox One and PC. But, they replace a lot of the things that are typically metal in the higher-end racing wheels. They just shift everything down to plastics, right?
Right.
So there's a couple metal bits in there, but it's mostly plastic enclosure, and, the bracket that holds it to the table is, a plastic thing. If you go down to, the last picture on the second page, you can tell there's, instead of metal supporting the backs of the pedals, there's just kind of, this mesh honeycomb-style plastic injection molded thing. It's still rigid, but it's much more lightweight, feels a lot less like an actual car when you're trying to be in a simulation and driving and whatnot. But at the end of the day, it's a budget-minded racing wheel with pedals for $200,
right?
So not a bad deal,
not at all.
Yeah,
good to know. Verge has a Google Wi-Fi review. Pretty simple. Quote, solid Wi-Fi coverage, easy setup, powerful app, but expensive, not as fast as other mesh systems, and lacks a USB port for network storage. I just thought I'd throw that in there. People have been curious about the Google Wi-Fi and its relationship to the previous Google networking products. And, I had a question about is On Hub going to go away? I'm like, who knows? It's Google.
The idea here is
Google Fiber was going to go away.
What is the idea here? This is just a router replacement?
Yeah, essentially. It's competing with Eero, Amplify, several other products on the market that are basically trying to use multiple boxes in your house to better distribute Wi-Fi coverage.
It looks kind of like the shape might be an inhibiting factor on doesn't have external antennas, and it looks like it's only 2x2 internally.
Almost all of these. There's arguments about whether or not you can get, whether or not you need external antennas or whether they can do fancy things involving, multiple internal antennas. All of these devices have in common that they're trying to be as aesthetically appealing or as aesthetically unobtrusive as possible, so that people will actually put them in places other than closets or, buried behind lead boxes.
And they're selling them in I think the idea is to be able to, if you have a larger home, to kind of pepper these things around your home, not just have just the one, right? Instead of one big one, you just have smaller ones kind of like distributed. They even have like a 3-pack for $300.
The big one on the, they're all sold in, you know, they're all sold in at least 2 and usually 3 packs. The one that was on the left in the picture that was up on the screen a second ago, the Orbi, that is actually using a dedicated, basically has a dedicated radio to backhaul internet between the Orbis and, you know, it's probably something I will need to write out in a 1,000-word essay before I kind of completely sort it all. But there's basically, you know, there's some that are mesh and there's some that are more like a router with dedicated extenders, in the sense that if you get more than one extender away from the router, you precipitously drop speed, which is not a true mesh network. But that's a that's a whole nother conversation. For a lot of people, the biggest advantage is they will be able to move anywhere in the house and they will have network coverage and they will not have to switch between, you know, different wireless access points. So the roaming ability there.
If you're a power user type, you kind of want to look for where, like the thing you were just saying, where your backhaul is like on a separate channel. It's not sharing time with, you know, if your radios are all connected to each other the same way that you're connecting to the router, to the mesh network, then that means that you have to share time with that device talking to whichever the main one is in your house. You know, being able to have a separate independent radio, separate channels, two things can actually talk at the same time, that's where you don't see a noticeable reduction in your throughput,
which would be nice. So
yeah, that's the way to go if you can do it.
I thought it was pretty crazy. Lenovo says there's going to be 12 Moto mods per year. So those are the snap-on backs the Moto Z phones. So this looks like it's going to be a thing moving forward, and that sounds like they might actually try to keep that design consistent over generations, which would be extremely awesome. But yeah, they're talking about Incipio, Mophie, Kate Spade, and Lenovo, and the article Jessica Dolcourt wrote up for CNET. And they count the year from April to April, so look for the number of mods to ramp up starting next spring.
Right? I'm hoping they don't get cheesy. Like, you know, the breathalyzer one is interesting, but like, you know, it doesn't take much to get really cheesy on this. And if you put yourself at a hard limit of we will do this many per year, like eventually there's going to be like, you know, the spinning top mod where you just like, you know, you pull it off and you spin it on a desk or something, like, you know, it could get really corny.
Yeah. Well, it's been frustrating for a lot of people. For example, the Hasselblad, Moto mod, which is like, oh, I'm gonna have a Hustle. This is the camera that went to the moon. By the way, shout out John Glenn, passed today. Just gonna lay that out there. You know, the reviews in the Hasselblad have been mixed because like the software was messy and it basically does zoom, but, you know, which is great because, you know, your cell phone probably doesn't zoom, not optically. But the image quality wasn't any better, particularly than the camera itself. You know, that was a $250 back. You know, other ones, have been JBL's audio backs have been, you know, kind of more popularly received. It's interesting.
Yeah.
There we go. Mod craziness, people.
Yep.
So,
I mean, I just feel like there are some people that are going to tinker and they're going to love this, but I feel like when it comes to phones, the vast majority of people are just like, yeah, I just want a smartphone.
I just want my phone to not like collapse when I put it in my pocket. I want it to work and I would like a cheaper data plan.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Western Digital HGST. Are making some massive hard drives.
And SSDs too.
So
Western Digital bought SanDisk and they've been merging with HGST for a long time. There's some complications there just that have been taken on a longer time with you know, inter-country meshing of two companies, I guess, that there's limitations on and whatnot. But I think they're going to kind of stick with HGST as the branding behind the enterprise product lines. And so they're going to have, they've updated their enterprise SSDs. They're going all the way up to 8 terabytes on the NVMe/PCIe style connected ones. as well as the SaaS connected ones, which is also still used in enterprise. They have a half height, half length PCI card. It's the SN260, I believe. That's going to use 8 lanes of PCI Express, which is not typical for an enterprise SSD. Usually they still use PCI Express 4 or 3.0 by 4. But the 8-lane variant will do like 6.2 gig per second, which is pretty darn good for throughput of a single SSD plugged into your system. And then, probably more importantly for those that follow HGST, those are the guys that are responsible for the whole helium-filled hard drive thing. They're the ones that kind of started that with the with a 6-terabyte model like several years back. That has now progressed all the way up to a 12-terabyte model, with a future announcement of a 14-terabyte model of the same hardware that will use shingled magnetic recording, which basically means you have to record things in relatively large sequential chunks as the tracks actually overlap each other slightly, which is how they're able to get, you know, the extra capacity on there, basically just squeeze the tracks together a little more. The catch is, since you're overlapping each track onto the next, it actually is like shingling a roof. So, you know, you kind of have to do that in one direction only. And so they kind of segment it up where it's relatively small chunks of tracks that they have to shingle. But it's, so it's sort of like a tape backup with a bunch of small tapes, relatively small tapes, right?
That's nerve wracking.
Yeah. But so the reason I like this is that it was the HE8, the 8-terabyte model of the HGST Helium versions that basically turned into the Western Digital Red 8-terabyte, which is a Helium full hard drive, but it's the exact same chassis. It's the same hardware. It's slightly different firmware. So the fact that this side of Western Digital is now like 2 jumps ahead, right? That means that pretty soon we'll probably see like a 10 terabyte Western Digital Red, or maybe even a 12 terabyte Western Digital Red. Like, I don't know, I'm kind of guessing here, but like maybe by the end of the year, next year or something like that. You know, I mean, that's good. It's good to see the hard drive capacity still continue to be pushed. And, you know, because that's, If not for SSD competition, like the hard drive stuff is still a goal for the SSD stuff to reach, right? You still have people out there that are like, I can get way cheaper cost per gigabyte out of a hard drive than SSD. And they don't understand that the hard drive performs like 1/1000th of the random access performance.
Right.
You know, like this is an enterprise grade HE12. And if you look at the spec sheet, like the IOPS rating is like, for a random read, it's 186. Not 186,000. It's 186. So you have SSDs that do like 100,000 IOPS, just as a comparison point there, right? You know, it's just really interesting that they're able to squeeze that many bits into, in this case, it's 8 platters.
That's, you know, pretty
so
crazy.
It's like, so each platter is like 1.5 terabytes for one small 3.5-inch platter. Pretty interesting.
That's
pretty
amazing.
Yep. And it's not using any heat assisted magnetic recording or any of that kind of next generation stuff. This is still just perpendicular magnetic recording where the poles are just vertical on the disc. So
nothing wrong with that, people.
Yeah.
Anything you're looking forward to at CES this year?
I mean, a lot of the stuff that we're seeing covered in like news pieces and stuff. Now we're probably going to end up like we're bleeding into like all that stuff we're going to potentially see on the show floor or in the back of some hotel suite somewhere, right? You know, I mean, we're at that point, right? Like where all the stuff that people are talking about as announcements of where chances are we're going to see in a couple of weeks and hopefully take pictures of and cover and, you know.
I can't decide if you're excited or just incredibly bored by it.
Well, no, it's just that I've lost count of how many of them I've done. So it's really just kind of like same as it ever was, time to make the donuts, whatever you want to call it. It's just I go to the thing, I go to the different places, you know. I'm excited about the new technology that's there, but as far as like the you know, the act of covering the thing, I'm probably less looking forward to, as you well know, because like we're just trucking our butts around Vegas trying to go from hotel to hotel.
That's true.
You know, with not enough time in between meetings to get from point A to point B, and with a bunch of other computer geeks basically trying to do the same thing and clogging up the whole taxi network. So, you know, yeah. I kind of wish there was a small back corner of one of the convention halls for CES that they just replaced, like they charged what they would charge for the hotel suites just to get those spaces, so that they were all just in like one place, like all the like core PC hardware stuff. If they just like stuck it all in one place, we could just like lap that thing within like 3 hours and get all the information we needed and we'd be done. But, you know, they have to make it more of an adventure.
It's a lovely dream, Alan.
Yeah, I know. That's totally a pipe dream. It's never happened.
I like it, though. With that, ladies and gentlemen, we should see Ryan Shrout back from his travels next week on PC Pur. Mr. Alan Malventano can be found not only in Kentucky, but online at PCPur.com, bringing the truth to the storage reviews. I was about to say something else. Completely inappropriate for a family podcast. You can find me at techthing.com, TEKTHING.com, or at AVXL.com. And we had a fun episode this week involving the world's finest hairdryer and DJI's Mavic Pro and more, including if you're looking for an affordable 1080p desktop monitor, we got picks for you. With that, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware. You can find all of our episodes and information on how to subscribe at twit.tv/twitch. And look, kids, there's Ryan Shrout right there. And me looking kind of bald, which is how I look. Thanks, everybody. Alan, thank you so much, man.
Yep. Thanks for having me.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.